It's Wednesday, June 30th, 2021, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Reynolds Journalism Institute's studio. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the Washington, D.C. City Council is considering a ban on menthol cigarettes. Among those against the proposal, the National Newspaper Publishers Association. I'll ask Ernest and Kathy why.
I was like screaming and I was cheering. I'm not even gonna lie, in my living room when I found out.
Score one for the cheerleaders' free speech. The Supreme Court ruled school officials were out of line, cutting her from the squad after her F-bomb-laden Snapchat post. We'll talk about that decision and others from different federal courts that came down this week. And pulling the curtain on the New York Times' investigation into Subway tuna sandwiches. What made them think to start a search for fishy DNA? But what we're going to start with today is what's happening in North Carolina. Just as we wrap up our afternoon taping of today's show, the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill Board of Trustees will be convening a special meeting to reconsider the hiring with tenure of Nicole Hannah Jones. We talked about this on our show a few weeks ago, and at that point, Hannah Jones said that if the board had not reconsidered their offer, which was going to be a five-year contract before reconsidering tenure, she would file a federal lawsuit. Then we didn't hear much until Wednesday when we learned she would not start her job tomorrow unless it is with an offer of tenure. So it's kind of hard to tell on the surface of things how much has really moved ahead in the situation in those couple of weeks. It's not really been clear.
Well, I don't know. I don't have any inside information. Excuse me. But I would think that the fact that the trustees are scheduling a meeting, that would suggest to me they are trying to avoid a lawsuit. So, you know, who knows? It's a special meeting. I think it was just scheduled earlier this week. But I do think here, you know, I think it can get very muddled up with issues of tenure. And I think when people outside the academy wonder about what is tenure, it can be confusing. But I think this boils down to a simple equity issue. The people who had the same job, the predecessors, the job that Nicole Hannah Jones would be taking, those people had tenure. They had very similar qualifications to her. Why is she not getting tenure? And the fact that she is a black woman and the other people were not of color, I think raises clear equity questions here. And that's what the trustees, I think, really need to focus on.
Well, I think part of the larger issue is probably the best way to put it. The larger issue here is this is doing irreparable, or has potential to be irreparably damaging mm-hmm. to the University of North Carolina as a whole. They've already lost several of their senior professors who have been basically lured away by other programs. They have lost people that they were potentially trying to hire. Because of
job
this,
candidates
and job candidates and people who had actually literally said, yes,
new
I'm
hires.
Going,
new hires,
yes,
people
I'm
who had
going.
Committed and, to new
yeah.
hire
and this came, you know, and then this happened and they said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to take it. And it sort of has also caused not just for faculty of color on the campus, but other faculty as well. It's just one more thing on top of all the other things that's happened in North Carolina when we go back to the Silent Sam statue and the fact that the board made a decision to pay the Sons of the Confederacy $2.5 million to take it away, which was then thrown out by a judge. And then all of the other issues that have come up in light of George Floyd, the way in which UNC handled, they weren't happy with the way UNC handled the pandemic restrictions on campus and those sorts of things. And people are just, they are just tired. And they go like, when is it going to be enough for the Board of Governors and the Board of Trustees to stay out of these sort of political issues, are making these things into political issues when they can just stay out of it and let the campuses solve it and handle it?
Yeah, I think the important thing here to note is that the faculty and the dean support this tenure.
As well as the provost.
Yes. And so the professionals involved in the program are all supporting the tenure. And it's the board of curators, the trustees of the university, who are blocking it. And many of them are political appointees.
Right.
One of the things that you had mentioned, Kathy, is that there's a lot of confusion around the idea of tenure. Who has it? Who doesn't? Even here at our School of Journalism, we have a majority non-tenured journalism school faculty. We have two Knight chairs, two chairs funded by the Knight Foundation, one with tenure, one who happens to be sitting to my right without tenure. Talk for a second about how or why tenure for this position matters when we're seeing in journalism education in so many ways that we're moving past that idea of tenure.
Right. Well, the trustees, the University of North Carolina trustees' action makes the best argument for tenure I've ever seen. It is suggesting that they are not giving tenure to a woman of color who has made her reputation and her fame on a project that is about slavery and the impact that slavery had on the United States of America. And in other words, they're saying it's controversial. We don't want to give tenure to somebody who's controversial.
Well, tenure being the promise of a job for life.
Well, protection really from political interference,
exactly,
is what I would say.
Yes,
I think
yes.
Especially at a public university, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about you as an academic, you can exercise your freedom of speech and your freedom of thought without fear that somebody who is politically opposed is going to be able to have a reprisal against you by getting you fired, cutting your salary, whatever. And I think that's what makes it important at universities for people, particularly who are mid-career, to have that assurance.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important. I mean, you know, one of the things that in order to be a top-flight university, which the University of North Carolina wants to be and has mm-hmm. been, you have to have these protections, because if you don't, then it's going to be difficult for you to be able to recruit high caliber academics as well as high caliber professionals like a Nicole Hannah-Jones to be able to come into that space and be able to bring their expertise in there and feel that they are going to be valued and supported. And they don't have to worry about, is someone looking over my shoulder, is someone taping my class and going to then use it against me, either in the political realm or in the social media realm, and cost me my job. And that's one of the things that in this case, tenure will protect the person doing this job from having to worry about those things.
Okay, well, so as I mentioned, we do record this program middle of the afternoon on Wednesdays. It runs on KBIA at 6:30 in the evening, obviously. So you can always go to KBIA's website at kbia.org and to our the views of the news section under the programs tab for an update on what happens here. The other big story that we're following this week has been the building collapse in the Miami suburb of Surfside. There's a sample of some of the really good reporting that has been done here. Several of the examples from the Miami Herald, but others as well from national publications. I wanted to ask if there were any specific stories or multimedia pieces, things that you have seen since last Thursday that stood out to you.
Well, one of the things that's really stood out to me is how quickly the Miami Herald and others were able to get the documents about how whether or not this building had been inspected. What did they find in the inspections? What did they know and what did they not know? And they reported that out by basically saying that, you know, there were some serious structural problems with this building. People had been notified. There was already talks and works in place to fix it, but nothing had been done in terms of making sure that many of the people in the building knew what was going on and probably should not have been in that building. And now you have all of these condos within that area, and probably across across the entire Surfside and Miami-Dade area, being going back looking at it and being inspected. And that's, to me, is really important, because yes, this is a tragedy that is still playing out, but what about all the potential other tragedies that are around, including its sister building, which
like
also
a block
has
away.
Problems. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, there was one story, and my bad, I can't remember if it was the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times that broke it, about a letter that had been sent by the condo president to the residents, mm-hmm. about the seriousness of this, the repair. It was couched, though, in terms of, we need you to pony up, and not so much in terms of the imminent danger. But I think that's right. I think also, then, of course, in a tragedy like this, the human side of it, and I think it was just today, the New York Times, or maybe yesterday, had a piece, they're just going floor by floor and telling the stories of the individuals. So I think there are two things happening here. One is, which we always try to do as journalists, is to put a human face on the tragedy, because that's important. It's lives that have been lost, lives that mattered to people. And then the other piece is, what happened and how can we keep it from happening again?
I mean, I think you're right in that. I mean, if we can focus in on the impact that this is having on people and show that just how important keeping infrastructure up to date, because that's part of the problem. Whether you're talking about private entities or you're talking about public entities, mm-hmm. our infrastructure in this country is crumbling. I mean, you have bridges. I mean, you know, I-55 over in Memphis, there was a huge crack that was discovered by one of the workers just happening to walk by and see the crack. It had just been inspected and no one said anything, right? And that entire bridge has now been shut down. If four or five more cars had come across that bridge, the whole thing would have collapsed like what we had in Minneapolis. These are the kinds of things that are happening all over the country right now. And part of it is because we just lack the will to deal with the massive infrastructure upgrades that need to be done.
Well, I think it's part of it is the polarization. You know, we have for decades been told the government can't do this. It's, you know, you're going to be cheated, fraud, waste, and abuse. And people are so suspicious of each other and so suspicious of anybody who's spending their money that we have stopped investing in ourselves as a country. And, I mean, we see it here in our own community. Just, right. I mean, you're practically swallowed up by potholes all the time because nobody can agree to add the extra tax money that it would take to fix these things. So I do
think— But it's
think,
even starting to yes. seep into private.
Yes.
It's one of the things, and it's really impacting individuals.
Short-term profits.
Right, right.
More important than the long-term investment.
Right.
There was one thing that kind of sparked some conversations, some use of language that was somewhat cringeworthy as some public officials, some reporters doing live shots described it as looking like a third world scene. These things don't happen here. They happen in third world countries. And I want to talk for a minute about how problematic that language really is. Ernest, you're nodding your head vehemently.
Well, yeah, I mean, you see it all the time. I mean, when these tragedies happen, in particular within the country, we start saying, but these are images that we see from overseas. Well, you know, actually, these are things that happen on a daily basis.
In the United States.
In the United States.
Katrina.
Yes.
People on roofs clinging to the top of the Superdome. There were Texas just a few months ago, people losing all of their power,
right.
and living in squalor.
Right.
And now this. Yes, it does happen in the United States of America, and there's a reason we're not investing in ourselves.
Right. I mean, think about what's going on right now in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, they're dealing
exactly.
with 100-degree temperatures, and people going like, this just can't be happening. You know, climate, whether you want to accept it or not, We are having some serious climate issues.
We can look at what's happened here, waking up last Friday morning to 5 inches of rain overnight. And
overnight in the span of an hour.
Okay, fair enough from the top. But it was, I woke up and there was 5 inches of rain. But the flooding and the infrastructure problems that were the result of inability to drain after days and days of overheating, there was nowhere for this water to go.
Right. But going back to the point that you
made,
I think journalists need to be cognizant of the words that they use and stop this sort of belief that this only happens someplace else. It happens right here.
What's interesting to me is that we've made such an effort within the profession to think about the language and how we're using language surrounding race, surrounding gender, surrounding sexuality, thinking about how differently we've been covering sexual assaults over the course of the last few years since the Me Too movement. But we don't think about it as quickly when it comes to what might be seen as class, as geographical assumptions, and making those really unfair and inaccurate connections.
You know, what bothers me is, can we just stick with the facts? What do you see?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what you see. And I know that may sound boring. It doesn't get clicks. You're not going to wind up on social media by doing that. But it does lend some authenticity and some accuracy to what it is you're doing. Tell me what you see and not what you think you see in terms of, wow, this is just horrific. I can't believe it's like, you know, sometimes, yes, it does call for that. But oftentimes we go overboard.
Well, I think it may be a ham-handed way of trying to express what we've been talking about here, which is assumptions we made about this country, comfortable assumptions about the place we live, because we have had strong institutions, because in the past we have been willing to make these investments, no longer hold.
Right.
That is no longer true. And so we cannot feel like we are on the right side of an invidious comparison. We're now actually on the wrong side. So it may, you know, I understand where they're going, but I agree with you, it's ham-handed. But I would think that's what some of the reporters are trying to suggest.
Okay, so there's an interesting story that's developing in Washington, D.C., where the city council is considering a ban on menthol cigarettes. This isn't new. The FDA considered a federal ban 3 years ago, and that failed. What's interesting, to me at least, is that one of the groups speaking out against it is a trade organization representing the Black Press. There's a longstanding relationship between the National Newspaper Publishers Association and Big Tobacco, as menthol cigarettes tend to be used in higher numbers in communities of color. So there's some advertising dollars that are changing hands here, but the newspaper, NPA. I wanted to not confuse it with the NPPA, which is the National Press Photographers Association. The NNPA says that their reason for being against this is more of a social justice and a crime prevention measure.
That's kind of hard to believe when you look at the facts. I mean, yeah, there may be some of that to it. They do bring up the fact that, you know, that in certain African American communities, even immigrant African communities, there's this buying and selling of singles, as they call them, which is individual cigarettes. There is that there, and they say, well, you know, this is a social justice issue because of what happened in New York
with Eric Garner.
And so, you know, I can understand that, but the longstanding relationship between the NNPA and Big Tobacco played more of a role in their decision to not support what the D.C. City Council was wanting to do. That had more to do with it than anything else. I mean, it's not just the advertising. They have supported them in many ways. They have underwrote many of their conferences. They have underwrote much of their travel when they do international. Big Tobacco is one of the longstanding, I would say, supporters of the NNPA, and that's fine if that's the way you want to go. But I think they need to be much more upfront about why it is that they're in support of Big Tobacco.
Yeah, I agree with what Erna said. I think, and I think you're seeing this, you see this over and over again with, I would say, underrepresented constituencies who do get support from corporate America, because corporate America is not stupid. Corporate America sees customers. So you see the same thing. There's always been controversy over gay pride events and all the alcohol distributors who are supporting them, or same thing with Cinco de Mayo.
Right.
So I think good for corporate America for showing up with their dollars, but I think it's incumbent upon the groups to acknowledge that financial motivation.
And I think it's pretty important to also understand that, you know, the NNPA also was one of the last trade organizations to basically come out against Big Tobacco when it came to the harmful effects of nicotine. Mm-hmm. It stood by Big Tobacco when pretty much everyone else had abandoned it and said, yes, nicotine is a leading cause of cancer, and cigarettes have a huge role to play in that. So this is all a part of a pattern and the relationship between the NNPA and Big Tobacco.
Okay. So it's that time of year again when we hear from the Supreme Court with its decisions from the cases that it's heard this past spring. And among the first cases we learned the outcome of, that of the cheerleader who dropped some F-bombs on Snapchat and was suspended from the squad. It was a pretty big win for that cheerleader, huh, Kathy?
Yes, absolutely. And a big win, I think, I wouldn't say a big win, a medium-sized win for free speech, because as a number of commentators observed, there were limits. The court could have gone a lot further in affirming a student's right to free speech. Didn't go all the way, but good for them.
So where was the line where they had stopped? Where could they have gone further?
Well, I mean, I think they could have been more emphatic about where students are allowed to speak without regulation by schools outside of the school. The court seemed to indicate that there are some instances where schools can still exercise some authority. So it's a little bit squishy, but certainly it's better than deciding the other way.
No, absolutely. I mean, to me, even when this case was initially filed and went before the Supreme Court, I was how could the Supreme Court not side with her? Because it was almost as if the school was basically saying, we will control all of your speech regardless of where you say it. And that's, I think, where many of the justices came into play. It was like, whoa, wait a minute. You may have some say in what a student says as it relates to the school, but when they put it out on their social media and they're talking about something else, you don't have any control over that.
The other key factor here is the student's speech was critical of the school.
Mm-hmm.
And so to get in the way of, I mean, you know, that is the fundamental to free speech, is the right to speak truth to power, and the right to criticize authority. And at a time when we see that being undermined in Hong Kong, in Belarus, in Nicaragua, it's really, really heartening to see our institutions continuing to stand up for that.
Right.
Okay, so there was another big decision that has some ramification for our own students, our student athletes here at the university and at other NCAA schools as well, that beginning tomorrow, they're going to have the ability to profit off of their likeness, off of their personal brands. That's a big deal.
That is a huge deal. Some are saying that this could be the beginning of the end of the NCAA, is basically, and the NCAA control.
Mm-hmm.
What ultimately could happen is you could have players basically being, you know, student athletes being paid to play. But in this instance, if a university uses their licenses, they have to go to the player and say, hey, if we're going to use your likeness, if we're going to use your name, if we're going to identify you, then you're due some compensation, and now you've got this negotiation. The flip side to that is, I mean, every student athlete out there gonna all jump in and find an agent to say, okay, I need you to negotiate my NIL, as they call it.
Mm-hmm.
That could be happening, especially when you talk about big name programs like an Alabama or a Kentucky on the basketball side. So, I mean, this is a huge deal for them.
Well, I think in large part, I think this is in response to another Supreme Court decision on a slightly related case on the NCAA, which was scathing. And Justice Brett Kavanaugh just ripped the NCAA a new one. And I think that decision has caused, there were some states, including Missouri, that were going to go and allow this NIL, as they call it, the name, image, and likeness marketing. But now the NCAA has said, oh, it's okay for everyone. And suddenly they did it right after a Supreme Court justice just ripped them one. So I think, you know, the walls could be tumbling down, and I think this is certainly an issue where if you talk to any sports writer, the contempt for the NCAA and the hypocrisy
of
all the money that's being made off these athletes without giving them a nickel, it's...
I mean, there are a lot of things that's happening here. I mean, we're talking about the name, image, and license, likeness of players right now. The other part is, which is coming down the pike, is the opening of the transfer portal where student athletes can transfer at any time. That has had a huge change in the NCAA, in particular in basketball and in what's normally called non-revenue generating sports like basketball,
sports,
the Olympic sports,
and that
sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's had a huge change there. This is those two things, the NIL and the transfer portal, is probably going to lead to a definite restructuring of the NCAA, even if it stays within its current name.
Okay. Before we go, move over Clara Peller. It's 2021, and now the New York Times is asking, where's the fish? Monday, they took us behind the scenes on a story they ran about 10 days ago on Subway tuna sandwiches. Now, when we sat down here, Ernest, you had some thoughts.
I had thoughts about the story itself. It was just too long. It didn't get to the point. The whole time I'm reading, I'm going like, is it tuna or is it not? I just want to know. Not that I really care, because I don't eat tuna. I don't eat tuna fish, but the way the story presented itself, it was going to give you some definitive information about whether or not Subway is actually selling tuna fish or not. You don't find out till you get deep into the end of a very long story. And that's the problem.
And
I have
spoiler alert, the answer is she doesn't know.
Right.
which is that much more aggravating.
Yeah.
I don't eat tuna either, but one of the things that I found interesting in looking at this yesterday was how they walked through the process of, like, the decision to even do the story that an editor just kind of threw out there in an office-wide communique. Who wants to go buy a bunch of tuna fish sandwiches from Subway and see what you find?
Yeah, it's all related to this lawsuit that was filed out in California by two people who... Again, they don't really like the sandwich, but they are just incensed the fact that Subway could be possibly selling tuna fish that has no tuna.
But isn't that kind of like saying, I'm going to file a lawsuit against Mystery Meat because I'm not sure what the mystery is?
Yeah,
I mean, it's canned fish.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, same thing you could say about spam. I mean, is it am? Is it not? You don't know.
That's part of the charm, isn't it?
See where this is going?
You know? Hey, Ernest, I got a question for you. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
Yeah, I don't know.
I do want to mention there are a couple of other big stories that are breaking today. We mentioned the Nicole Hannah Jones story at the beginning of the show. Also today, news that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has overturned the conviction of Bill Cosby. A couple of things we'll be looking at as we start to think about what we'll be talking about next week. One other that I'm going to put on your radar right now that I thought about putting in today's show and didn't have time. The 50th anniversary of Gene Wilder's Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Oh. So start getting nostalgic now. That music means we are out of time for today's show. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about each of the topics we talked about on our links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave comments, questions, see what else we'll be talking about next week, and more. Thanks to Travis McMillan for directing today's show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you next week.